Welcome to episode 43. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health as it continues through its year of intense bargaining, a big thanks to all those community health members who provided a response with respect to the draft outline. The draft outline was intended to provide a response to the various unions and their logs of claim. It was developed by the EBA working group, which was made up of volunteers. That will help us expedite the process for moving the agreements forward for allied health professionals, for dietitians, psychologists and pharmacists, as well as the health and allied services agreement. With respect to health service members, this week we're meeting with the rural and regional HRIR managers utilising go-to meetings. If you have not yet had a chance to participate in one of those monthly meetings that occurs on the second Wednesday of every month except for January, please don't hesitate to contact our office and the go-to link will be sent to you. It's been an extremely effective method for keeping in touch with our rural and regional members this year. We're also looking forward to attending the Warren Mang conference on the 24th of November and meeting with rural and regional members on that date. Also this week, there is the Doctors EBA reference group that's being conducted as we're getting to the last stage of bargaining there. And there's also a meeting with regards to Clause 49 of the Mental Health Agreement concerning CWMS. Our rural community health members should this week also receive a new look industrial relations report, which talks about the stages of bargaining. And just a brief reminder that during the course of November, members will be receiving a link through the email for the podcasts and also through the app for the inaugural VHAA podcast quiz. Fame, glory and an oversized gold gnome are for the taking by participating in the VHAA podcast quiz. We'll be announcing the winners in December. As always, all the bargaining meetings are being updated through the VHAA community app. And that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is VHAA consultant and a man for whom it's always Movember, Alec Jonoff. Welcome, Alec.
Thank you, Stuart. Nice to be here.
Alec, the way this works is that we reveal a clue which will suggest the subject for the discussion. And we do that by lifting up the box and then describing the object for the benefit of those people who are listening rather than watching. So would you do the honours and reveal this week's mystery object? So for the benefit of those people who are listening rather than watching, could you describe what it is under the box?
Absolutely nothing.
And there's a reason for that. The reason there's nothing under the box is that this week's subject for discussion is simply too big to be contained within a mere box. So this week's clue is something a little bit, not so much under the box, but out of the box. So could you describe what it is that you see, which is the subject matter clue for this week's discussion? And if you like, I'll build the suspense.
Looks like an appendage to Tiny Tim.
It's a ukulele. And on the basis of that clue, what would you say was the subject for our discussion today?
Well, it's coming together of a number of unions in a very sporadic way with a very small song to sing.
That is possibly the best answer I've ever received, but still completely wrong.
Doesn't surprise me.
The clue is meant to represent that we are here to discuss what Uke have been doing lately.
Groan.
So, what you've been working on lately, you've been working on the maintenance agreement lately.
Yes,
and
that's correct.
So we're just going to have a chat about the terms of settlement that have been recently prepared. And as I understand it, that's reached a particular point, that there was a meeting set for the 27th of October, the purpose of which was to endorse the proposed terms of settlement.
That's correct, Stuart. The unions did meet. They didn't get the numbers that they'd hoped, but those that did attend endorsed the agreement in principle. And so we will now do the rest of the mechanical issues to give full effect to the agreement.
And I think it's probably worth mentioning in terms of meetings of that kind, which are for the purpose of endorsing proposed terms of settlement, do the normal conventions in terms of time release and payment apply?
Yes, they have and they did. That is, where an agreement in principle is reached and the unions are going to recommend the settlement, then the convention, a long-standing convention, is that members are released to vote on that with full pay.
And I guess the maintenance agreement is really one of our lesser known agreements. Mm. So starting off by the unions that are covered off by that agreement and who participated in the bargaining process, which unions are covered by the maintenance agreement?
There are three unions and one of them has two branches, the AMWU, the CFMEU and the CPEU, which both covers the plumbing union and the electrical union. So in practical terms, there's four, but there will only be three signatories in practical terms.
And how many employees does the maintenance agreement cover?
About 212 at last count.
So members are very accustomed to nurse-to-patient ratios. Would this have the highest union-to-staff member ratio?
Probably. It's not certain. I think times have changed a bit, but there is a relatively high level of membership of those unions for these occupations.
And just in terms of the bargaining process that we've been engaged in for the past couple of years, members have had a broad awareness of how that bargaining has unfolded. Yeah. But how did it unfold in the context of the maintenance agreement?
A little differently to all the other unions. One of the phenomenons of this group is they serve a common log.
So a single log rather than
single
three
log
or four.
Rather than separate unions. And this has always been the case with this group of unions. And they did serve ultimately a common log, which was only a one-page document.
Okay, so in terms of the number of claims, they...
A limited number of claims with little material surrounding each claim. They were almost dot points.
So that really suggests a more cut-to-the-chase kind of approach rather than a broad ambit approach where the parties then spend time peeling back the layers.
Very much. The logs contain the classic application for construction industry provisions. They do that routinely or ritualistically. We ritualistically reject those. And it was very clear at a very early stage that they were looking for a quick, pragmatic settlement based on general outcomes that have already been achieved in the health industry and some other particular conditions.
I was going to ask that question in the sense that this agreement comes up for negotiation at a time where there's already been a significant amount of public sector bargaining.
Correct.
So is it fair to say that the bargaining that had already occurred had a substantial impact on this round of bargaining for maintenance?
Once we stripped away this sort of, how would I call it, the ambit matters, then it very much quickly descended down into the brackets that the public sector agreements basically created for us. And they were basically the wage outcomes, the broad public sector wage outcomes of three and a bit, give or take a little bit, depending which union, putting nurses 8 years aside, and also the common clauses. So there was little resistance to the notion, the concept of common clauses, let alone to their actual clauses themselves.
So effectively those principles had already been established?
Largely established and not particularly contested.
And in terms of the frequency of the negotiations, when did they start, how long did they take, how often did the parties meet?
Depending which union you're talking about. One of the things that has bedeviled the timeframe for this is the unavailability of one or other of the several unions at any given time.
So getting everyone into the room?
Getting everyone into the same room at the same time has been probably the more challenging bit than the negotiations themselves. But suffice to say, two of the unions were constant attendees, more or less. That is the ETU and the Plumbers Union. And they informed me that they had authorities to proceed. They were carrying the authorities of the other two unions. I took that in good faith and there was no reason to doubt it, and subsequent events confirmed that was in order.
And did they take carriage for updating the other two unions with regards
Absolutely.
To the progress of the
yes,
discussions?
They yes, they did.
And in terms of the meetings with the unions, do normal construction rules apply? Is it a toolbox meeting? Does it start at 7 a.m?
No, they made a concession to the real world and we started at 8 a.m. The meetings rarely lasted longer than an hour. It's fair to say they had not done a lot of research and were only focused on some key items and wanted to prosecute those, and quite readily dropped off a number of matters that they knew ultimately they were never going to achieve.
So turning to the agreement in principle itself, one of the items that jumps out is that there's an express statement to the effect that the coverage for the new agreement is unchanged, that it covers same group of people.
That's correct.
So what kind of occupations does the maintenance agreement cover?
It's quite diverse in terms of trades classifications, but the critical classifications that are relevant really to hospital maintenance are in the electrical and plumbing areas, and that covers particularly higher level tradesmen, so electricians special class, plumbers with particular higher level certifications that enable them to do complex work. And in many ways that distinguishes them from other occupations. In the smaller hospitals, you might have one plumber and might maybe have one electrician. I have got some where there's only a carpenter and a painter. It's historical. The truth is, the maintenance area of hospitals is shrinking as more and more maintenance is contracted out and driven by service agreements.
One of the things that we get as a frequently asked question is, where is the line between the Health and Allied Services Agreement and the Maintenance Agreement drawn? So the Health and Allied Agreement has provision for a handy person with a trade qualification.
Yes.
And, of course, there are a range of trades that are qualified trades that are covered by the Maintenance Agreement. Where is that line drawn?
The line is, the practical line is that the handy person came first and then the bracket trade qualification came at a later stage. And the essential employment practice distinction is hospitals sometimes have handymen, and if they're lucky, they can get someone with a trades qualification. He might only be part-time. But typically those people do not have the extra certifications, certificates and additional quals to do the heavy duty maintenance stuff, such as electrician special class, refrigeration mechanic, and so on.
They're not specialised?
No, they're not sufficiently specialised to be able to do a spectrum of work that's critical to the maintenance of hospital infrastructure.
One of the other items that comes out from the terms of settlement is the fact that the new agreement is comprehensive in nature. That is, it doesn't rely on previous agreements as such.
That's right. It will be another comprehensive agreement, which will be a complete code of employment.
And that's
very
consistent.
Very much like nurses and other agreements that are common in the public health sector.
And that's consistent with the preceding agreement?
Yes, absolutely.
And so the nominal expiry date for the proposed new agreement?
The 30th of August 2021.
So a couple of things stand out for that, one of which is that it maintains this agreement as being, I guess, almost in the off-season for bargaining. That is after a large number of agreements have been renegotiated for the next round.
Yep.
Yep, that's true. It cyclically, historically, that's how it's gone. It gets the benefit of the outcomes of the big agreements, the big health agreements, obviously. But it also gives room to create space for anything that might be special to this group.
And the 30th of August, obviously, is also my wife's birthday. Was there a particular reason that the unions wanted to celebrate my wife's birthday that way?
Not that they mentioned.
You're not suggesting they're not connected?
I rather suspect they're not connected.
Not connected. Not connected. Alrighty. So it remains an agreement that is effectively in that sort of off-season as such.
Yes.
But expiring in the second half of 2021, when was the anniversary of the last one expiring?
30th of November 2016.
Okay, so it's it really
the
stretches
reason, the
out.
The reason for the 30th of August and the operative date for wage increases is the 1st of the 9th, because that's the anniversary of the last increase in the last agreement.
Okay. And when would renegotiations commence for a new agreement?
The agreement in principle stipulates 6 months, but if history is any guide at all, the unions will turn up about a month after the agreement's expired and put a log down.
What's interesting, though, if the last one expired at the end of November 2016, there was still a lot of activity in the context of we had some outcomes for some of the big agreements. Some of them were still in play.
Correct.
So it's easy to see how it is that bargaining was deferred for a little while.
I rather doubt that the deferral was a tactical positioning by the maintenance unions. I think it was, frankly, to be perfectly blunt, more attributable to this is not a group that attracts a great deal of union attention. And they were, frankly, quite ignorant of the cycle of health agreements and what their outcomes were until I informed them.
So just in terms of the wage increases, that's always a subject of great interest. What are the wage increases that are applying to this group?
There are four increases, all applying from the 1st of September of each of the next 4 years.
Is that the first full pay period on or after?
First full pay period on or after for each of the increases. 4.25% for the first year, that is from 1st of September this year. And then the subsequent 3 years are 3% each.
And in terms of this group of employees, there's one interesting item that stands out in that the people who are covered by this agreement do not always get paid the agreement rate. They are often paid above that rate.
Invariably.
So in practical terms, how do those wage increases apply to that group of employees who are paid above the agreement currently?
Historically and this time around, the increases that we've just spoken of are applied to the actual remuneration, as distinct from the paper rate that's embodied in the agreement itself.
So the practical effect of that is that everybody who is covered by
this agreement... Everyone's contracted rate goes up by 4.25%.
Everyone gets those increases.
So, correct.
Rather than absorption. So I do note that...
Very much like specialists. The parallels haven't escaped me and probably not you.
That may well be true, but I'm sure we'll edit that comment out.
I thought you might.
So I did notice an interesting comment in the terms of settlement document with regards to the increases applying to the current rates.
Yes.
But also that the rates that currently apply to the existing employees would also apply to successor employees.
Yes.
That's quite a curious term.
It is it's a curious term, and it's certainly an unusual outcome. For some considerable time, I told the unions that may well be difficult to achieve because it's about binding employers on arrangements that are unique to existing employees. After much discussion about the realities of the labour market for these occupations, the issues of recruitment and retention, the fact that this is potentially a shrinking workforce. So there were a number of factors being discussed because the union said this is a bottom line for them. And the question was, well, do we accept that as a bottom line or not? After a lot of consultation with our members about this issue, particularly in the context of retaining skilled people who are very experienced in hospital maintenance, in the context of a workforce pressure where a lot of tradespeople are being sucked out of public sector into major infrastructure. So there was a common acceptance that this needs to be guarded against. The other acceptance, which is of a longer standing, is we always do this anyway, out in hospital land.
So that was the practical effect?
This is a practical outcome, as distinct from an industrially normal or conventional outcome.
So it's a little bit unorthodox?
It's unorthodox for sound reasons. And those reasons are very much linked to the peculiar nature of these particular trades classifications.
And just to drill down into that a little bit further, the expression in the terms of settlement document referring to remuneration arrangement, which strikes me as something that is potentially broader than merely the salary, is that correct?
It's salary and a myriad of allowances. What has happened over many, many, many years is individual employees have been engaged on contracts, individual contracts, and at the local level, hospitals have done what used to be called over-award arrangements. And this has proliferated and it's been commonly accepted, certainly for at least 20 years to my certain knowledge.
So the terms
and
of
the hospitals, frankly, didn't want to disturb that.
The terms of settlement then refers to an exchange of letters.
Exchange of letters or a memorandum of understanding.
In order to identify and give effect to that provision.
And give expression to a commitment by all parties.
Is there a time frame under which that needs to occur?
Yes, that will happen before the formal agreement is submitted to the Fair Work Commission processes. So that will be those documents will be tabled as part of the commission. The reason this is done not inside the EBA is because industrial policy of the state government precludes those kind of arrangements within an EBA. And that's all. That's the only reason for that being done.
In a sense, it would go slightly to the issue of the better off overall test.
Oh, well, indeed. Absolutely.
The terms of settlement document also refers to a remote recall allowance.
Yes.
And also to the changing nature of work. Again, in the context of doctors, we've had a lot of discussions this year about the changing nature of work. Yes. How did that discussion manifest itself with this particular group?
Well, it manifested itself from the current agreement. The current agreement actually makes provision for the parties to discuss the utility of a remote recall allowance in the next agreement, i.e. the one we've just done.
So there wasn't an existing remote
there
recall?
There wasn't an existing remote recall provision, but there was clearly recognition by the parties that that's something that needed examination next time around. And that's exactly what we did. And what I put to the unions is, well, we've now done a remote recall provision across several health agreements. Here it is. It serves the purpose. What do you think? And they read it and said, that makes sense to us, we'll accept it.
Yeah, and in terms of the incidence of that kind of remote recall, that is where a maintenance employee is disturbed out of hours but is able to complete the work without returning.
Correct.
How often is that currently occurring?
It is quite patchy. In some places it's relatively routine. In other hospitals, because of different way they structure their workforce and how decisions are made, it's less so. But what is the common thread is there is more technology that enables remote work on things such as fault finding, diagnostic, analytics, which enables a remote decision to be made or a remote recommendation to be made.
It's interesting that we're talking about the changing nature of work across different occupational groups and really suggests that we're going to be talking about that a lot in the years to come.
I think the pace of technological change and the capacities it will provide will make this a very big issue for our workforce.
I think so. Mm. We talked before about the common clauses and that there was some understanding and some acceptance of the benefit of having some consistency with other health agreements.
They certainly did. There was no resistance to that at all.
So the common clauses include?
They include none of those that would surprise anyone. Family and domestic violence, discipline, dispute resolution procedure, consultation and organisational change, transition to retirement, fitness for work and compassionate leave. I did offer breastfeeding, but the gentleman at the table didn't think that was particularly necessary. But of course, we can easily put it in because it does no harm.
I do think it is actually, it is worth including just on the basis that we don't know what the workforce is going to look like, and we want to make sure that there's room for.
That's right.
Room for everyone.
That's right.
All of our agreements must have a service delivery partnership plan. What does the service delivery partnership plan look like for this group?
The service delivery partnership plan for this group is fairly stock standard. You'll find it's rather similar to many of the others. Mm-hmm. The only point of difference that has been identified, and we had to put this in, is at item F, which, and I'll read it, jointly give consideration to the scope for creating a contemporary classification structure, and so it goes.
The classification structure reference stood out.
Was
there much in the way of discussion around classification structure?
There's been a lot of discussion about classification structures for at least 18 years to my certain knowledge.
So a relatively new issue then?
Relatively new. Enthusiasm for it is waning rapidly, and that's why the words give consideration to, rather than to do it, was put in, because the prospect of having the unions attend an exercise of that kind is, you wouldn't rate it as high.
Notwithstanding the fact that doubtless they're looking forward to attending the SDPPWGs over the life of the
agreement.
They
cannot wait to be party to the SDPWG.
I thought as much.
A bit like myself.
The terms of settlement have been circulated to members through Bulletin 2227.
2272.
And that sort of leads to the question, what happens next?
Well, what happens next is we've already drafted the agreement in draft form. That's been submitted to the unions. They've ticked off on it. It's now going up through the approval process through the Department of Health and Human Services, which goes up through the hierarchy of approval of government. And once government formally approves it, then we can put that agreement to the ballot process. And once the ballot process is completed, then, of course, application was made to Fair Work Commission for formal approval of the agreement.
So just in terms of that time frame, the document has already been submitted to the governmental process?
Yes, it has.
And do we have a sense of those things are never certain in terms of their time frame?
And there's no greater certainty now than there has been for several other agreements. For example, the medical scientists agreement was with government for 4.5 months before it was approved.
Hmm.
I've been told that do not expect a quick response.
Right.
Now, what that means, we're left to speculate a little bit. But even when we get it back, and let's say we got it back at the end of November, and I think that would be optimistic, then getting it into the commission, we can get it into the commission maybe just before Christmas.
Hmm.
But there's a delay process within the commission itself, as you know. So the prospect of having this agreement formally approved prior to Christmas I would regard as remote at the moment.
For as long as I can remember, industrial relations has always been broken up into before Christmas and after Christmas. In terms of categories, it sounds as though this is likely to be after Christmas.
This is more likely to be after Christmas than not.
But it also suggests that members will need to stay tuned as to the time frame.
I think what we will do, of course, like we do with many other agreements, is provide a draft salary circular to members with the appropriate advice well ahead of the formalities being concluded so that they can prepare whatever they have to prepare. What I do anticipate is that the unions, because of the perceived delay, may well seek to pressure government to enable pay action to commence prior to formal approval.
And again,
on current indications, government will not do that.
That's not been an unusual request.
Quite.
Alec, those are all the things that I wanted to cover off today. So thank you for taking us through the maintenance agreement. What we normally do now is that whilst the credits roll, one of us performs the VHA theme song. So as the guest, I think you should start.
Is there a theme song, is there?
There is. Tim wrote it.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Thank you, Alec.
Pleasure. That'll do, I think.